From HanselMinutes.com, it's Hansel Minutes, a weekly discussion with web developer and technologist Scott Hanselman. This is Lawrence Ryan announcing show number 554. In this episode, Scott talks with Safia Abdallah about new ways to think about interactive computing.
Hi, this is Scott Hanselman. This is another episode of Hansel Minutes. Today, I'm talking with Safia Abdallah, who is the maintainer of Interact and a data scientist. How are you?
I'm doing great, Scott. How are you?
I am lovely. Thanks for chatting with me today. I've been watching your stuff online, and you have more side hustles and more cool stuff going on than most people like have in their day jobs.
Yes, I'm a perpetual hustler.
You can't stop, and you've taken on another new project recently.
Yes, I have.
So Interact, it's not I-N, but it's just the letter N, Interact.
Mm-hmm.
Interact is a popular literate coding notebook. You've got almost 500 stars on GitHub here.
Yeah.
And it's not just Interact, but it's a whole kind of family of sub-projects underneath it. But
yeah.
What is a literate coding notebook?
That's a great question. So a literate coding notebook is a document that allows people to have markdown text, so textual content, narrative, stories, and along with that, code that's executable and embedded. So if you have a computational narrative that you want to share, you can tell that narrative and back it up with the code that follows. So if we think about a lot of the really interesting things that are going on in data journalism and scientific computing, Interact is the perfect place for all of that.
It seems like this is an instance of a general problem or a general solution that I'm seeing a lot more of. A number of years ago, I saw an application called Calca, C-A-L-C-A. Are you familiar with Calca?
No, I'm not.
So Calca came out in 2013, and basically you type some markdown, and then suddenly you type an equation, and then it solves it. And then you keep typing some prose. So it would be as if you were writing an article about fixed rate mortgages.
Yeah.
And then suddenly in the middle of it, there was equations that isn't quite MathML, but it's very mathy.
Mm-hmm.
And it's no longer a document. It's a living, breathing notebook.
Yeah, that's a great analogy. And you're right. It definitely is kind of part of this larger revolution that's going on in computing. I think as computers and technology and programming become more involved in our lives and people become more proficient users of technology, we start to think of really interesting ways to integrate them into the way that we tell stories.
Mm-hmm.
And it happens to people like journalists and scientists. My dream in the future is that anyone who has an interesting story, whether they're working in civic tech or whether they're an elementary school teacher, can use the power of literate coding to share that narrative and back it up with computation.
So starting kind of 15, 20, 30 years ago, like we started with HTML, and then there was a time in the middle 90s when we were doing MathML. But MathML was just a way to like render something. But it didn't really live. It was just a picture, you know? When did things go from, when did the interactivity get injected into the conversation? Was it JavaScript that needed to make that happen?
Yeah, I think the interactivity really happened when the web came to be, the modern web as it is, I think.
Yeah, yeah.
To make
the JavaScript-friendly web,
yeah,
the one that we're not too afraid of.
And to kind of put Interact into perspective and explain some of the history behind it, the predecessor or the grandpa of Interact is a technology called Jupyter Notebook. Jupyter Notebook was developed a couple of years ago, and it's entirely written in JavaScript on the front end, uses jQuery, back when jQuery was very popular. And it relies on this messaging protocol called the Jupyter Messaging Protocol that defines how an interactive front end can communicate with a back end that provides the actual ability to execute the code. So you provide the front end that's like the pretty cells, the editing interface, all that fun stuff. and there's a kernel, as it's called, on your machine or on a remote server that's responsible for executing the code that you send to it. And Jupyter was the project that really laid the groundwork for this kind of interactivity and this kind of messaging between front ends and back ends. And NREACT builds on that with some more modern technologies. So we're using React on the front end for our components. And it's entirely built in JavaScript because we're a little obsessed with that. Mm-hmm. And you might be wondering, you know, it's using React, but it's a desktop application. Like, it integrates seamlessly with my desktop. I can click to open files. I can have it on my dock or on my desktop. And that's because of a really cool technology called Electron, which I think kind of speaks to the power of the web. Electron gives you the ability to package HTML, CSS, and JavaScript into a desktop-based application that kind of runs in a Chromium browser on your desktop. And we use that to make NREACT integrate seamlessly with the desktop. I like to say NREACT is the best of the web and the best of desktops all in one.
Mm, yeah, we actually had one of the originators of Electron on the show, and Jessica Lord.
Yeah, she's an awesome lady.
Yeah, about 10 or 20 episodes ago, so people can check that out. So going back a little bit farther in history, though, because we talk about, you talk about how Jupyter, and that's Jupyter with a Y instead of an I, is kind of like the grandfather. If you keep going farther and farther back, there was IPython, which was kind of like interactive Python, right? Mm-hmm. And then the more general concept of a REPL, it seems like having a REPL, like an interactive, you know, read, eval, print loop at the command line was one early, early thing, you know, 30 years ago. But then when IPython allowed you to be manipulating something graphical, something simultaneous, like you'd have your text and then you'd have your chart and you'd type something and the chart would change. Mm-hmm. That was when this interactive notebook thing kind of popped, don't you think?
Yeah, it's been sort of a slow evolution. You started off with IPython. IPython was called IPython because it was that interactivity, but the kernel that you can communicate with in the backend was just Python. So that limited it to Python users. And the kind of jump from being called IPython to Jupyter wasn't a change in technology so much as it was a way to communicate to users that, you know, you don't have to just use this with Python. If you're working with Julia, if you're working with R, if you're working with .NET, you can use this interactive platform to create interactive notebook documents. And then NREACT just kind of continues that vision and brings it to the desktop and adds a couple of fun stuff to it. But yeah, I think this is just something that we've been progressing to as people who think about what's the best way for programmers, scientists, researchers to use computers to share their stories. And really, it's a way for you to communicate something to your computer and then get something back really quickly. And that back and forth, making it more seamless and natural and informative every step of the way. If you think about a REPL, it does the job, but it's not the most informative infrastructure. If you think of something like a JavaScript-based front end that allows you to have charts, that allows you to have other dynamic components, you can get more information about from each kind of read evaluation loop, if you think about it.
That's how
I like to see it.
No, I think that's a great point. And it feels like, so if REPLs then were for programmers, but weren't expressive enough, weren't easy enough, and then Jupyter started thinking about things for data scientists, do you think that interact is the kind of thing that could become general enough that non-technical parent could find themselves using it?
Yeah, that was one of our big goals with the project and the reason that we decided to make it desktop-based. The web is king for a lot of places, but I think most computer users still rely on desktop applications. They still use Word, they still use Excel, and they really feel at home working with applications based in the desktop that allow them to integrate with things like their menu bar in Chrome or their Finder or Explorer on Windows. So we want to bring that technology to the user where they feel most comfortable, the desktop. And we also want to focus a lot on user experience. So anyone who's listening, I strongly encourage you to go download the NREACT alpha release and play around with it and just experience how seamless it is and how natural it feels to use something. One of our big focuses was making this something that was accessible to the, sounds terrible, but like the lowest denominator of technical users. We wanted somebody who was non-technical to be able to figure it out really quickly, and somebody who was highly technical to be able to be extremely productive in it because it has such a low barrier to entry.
Interesting. Okay. So when I think of, again, we're trying to be respectful that, you know, it's not bad to be a non-technical person. It's just you're a non-technical person. I think of, like, I always think of non-technical parent, and I know that non-technical parent or non-technical business user can use Excel, and like Excel has almost kind of taken over the world.
Yeah.
Which is a good thing and a bad thing. but it's still very, you know, it's grids and it's charts within grids and things like that. Are you thinking that that business user could move from the kinds of things that they're shoehorning into Excel and maybe consider Interact for that?
Yeah, I would hope so. And I think even a better way to think about it is as a connection point between, say, data scientists in a firm and business analysts in a firm. So say you're a data scientist, you're working on some computation, you're building a model, you're thinking through something. You write up your thoughts and your narrative in a single notebook file. You email it over to a business analyst or a manager at your firm who might have minimal knowledge about what you're doing and might just want to be up to date about what it is. And they can open that document as they would a Word document and engage with it. And I think the possibilities for a platform that connects highly technical data scientists, researchers, etc., with non-technical users is so powerful because it's really bridging that knowledge gap between people and that communication gap between people. And that's where I think it comes in most handy.
I see. So it wouldn't be that I would give, like my wife is a business analyst type person. She's got an MBA and she understands things I don't.
Yeah.
I would make a notebook, an IPYNB notebook, and then I would create that structure and then send her that file and she'd receive it as a document, just like she gets a Word document.
Yeah. And if she had Interact installed on her machine, which hopefully she would because it is cross-platform, so anyone using any operating system can use it, all she'd have to do is double-click that email and it would open up on her computer and she could read it, change the code if she felt super brave and daring, or just look at the results that you sent her.
Interesting. Okay. So when did you get involved with this project? Because I see that it's been around for a little while and there's lots of committers. But when I look at the chart, it sounds like there was a moment when you got pretty jazzed about it and suddenly your commit graph got bigger.
Yeah, that's a great question. So I got involved with Interact in mid-May 2016. I got involved with the literate coding ecosystem in general in August of 2015 when I started contributing to the Jupyter Notebook, which is, as I mentioned previously, the grandpa of Interact. And since I got involved with Interact in 2016, I've done a little bit of everything. I do development, I manage the Twitter account, I do some writing for the blog, I write grants so that we can get funding for our open source project. I work on community management. I figure out how to get into conferences to speak about the project. I'm kind of like a jack of all trades in that respect.
Well, certainly those people are needed. Like I see lots of people who go and do some open source and they maybe write the core bit of code and then they commit it and then they wonder why no one comes to their site.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
You know, someone sent me a project recently to look at and they wanted me to tweet about it and share about it. But they had no readme.
Oh.
They had no website. They had no getting started. It was just code.
Yeah.
And it sounds silly to say that, but you know, Git clone is kind of a big, that's asking a lot of me as a person who just visited your site.
Yeah. That's one thing I think a lot of people fail to realize in my perspective. Of open source is that it's a lot like running a startup or a business, except that you don't make any money and you also don't get paid. but you do have to have the ability to market your project. You do have to have the ability to understand who's going to take the biggest advantage of my project and be able to leverage it in interesting ways. And how can I get a hold of those people and get them into using it in their business or sponsoring it or any kind of engagement. How do I engage with the community? How do I publicize my project? How do I get funding? All that good stuff. It's basically like being a little entrepreneur, and that's what I love about it, is I do have this entrepreneurial side to me, and being in open source allows me to activate that and energize it every day.
Doesn't that ask a lot, though, of people? Like, for example, this is a project that's currently kind of by and for data scientists, but now you're describing, you know, managing a Twitter account and making sure the README is clean and making sure the docs are good and has an attractive website.
Yeah.
That's skills that maybe they don't have.
It is a lot. And I think with open source, you can do as much as you feel comfortable doing. I'm the kind of person who loves to be involved with all kinds of different things. I don't want to be just the programmer, just the developer. I want to be the marketer and the social media manager and the writer and the dev evangelist. And I have the space to go crazy with all that in open source. Nobody's going to stop me and say, no, Safia, you can only just submit PRs and review PRs, and that's all you're going to do. And likewise, there are other people on the project who do just stick to development because that's what they're most comfortable with, and that's their talent, and that's totally okay. So with open source, you can go as far as you're comfortable with and just make it your space to be a great developer, a great writer, a great manager, a great marketer. It's kind of your playground, and that's what's so fantastic about it.
I think I don't like to use the word unicorn, but sometimes that you're kind of describing a unicorn in the sense of, I don't know how many data scientists that could also do all the things that you just described.
I might be a bit of a unicorn.
But your background is mostly in data science. Like that's your space that you're most interested in, right?
Yeah, I got really interested in data science when I was 13 years old. I was a total documentary geek. And I came upon this documentary about the Google search engine. So describe the early days of Google and how they built it. And I got really interested in search engines and started researching a lot into information retrieval, which is the general field of building search engines, and fell down the rabbit hole of learning about machine learning and AI and natural language processing and all that fun stuff. And ever since then, I've just been completely obsessed with the power of the field. And even more so, and this kind of draws back to my interest in building a desktop application that makes research and data science accessible to common people, I'm interested in making sure that non-technical people or semi-technical people have an understanding of what data science is and what machine learning is and what its role in our world is, because it's everywhere. And the scariest thing for me is to live in a world where machines are doing things that impact us that we don't understand. So I work hard to kind of teach people about machine learning, and I do free workshops in Chicago and all that fun stuff, because I don't want the robots to take over.
Skynet, preventing Skynet is your primary.
I am preventing Skynet.
So that's interesting, because you're saying that it's open source that is the thing that will prevent us from taking this software for granted. Like, if you know what it's doing, you don't have as much fear over that thing.
Yeah, and it doesn't even have to be open source. If you just have an understanding of how it works, that can go a long way to making you feel comfortable and making sure that you're a more mindful internet user. So I would hope that, like, in the future, everyone in the world would understand how search engines work and how ads work and how Facebook's newsfeed works. But the reality is that most internet users don't know that. And that's really alarming to me.
Backing up a little bit and talking more about Interact, you called out very clearly that there's the electron front end, and then you referred to this kernel concept. Mm-hmm. And when I initially set up Interact on my machine, it said, not connected. What is the difference between the kernel and what is that concept? Because kernel is kind of an overloaded term.
Yeah, it is. Kernel kind of is one of those really technical terms, and it seems scary and frightening. And I would encourage everyone who's listening to go to my website, which is safia.rocks. I've got a talk that explains how kernels work and how the entire Jupyter messaging protocol works. But to give a brief summary of it, a kernel is essentially a program that runs either on your local machine or in a remote server that has the ability to take messages as input, parse them, figure out what to do with them, and send a response back.
Okay, so this is in the context of a Jupyter kernel.
Yes, in the context of a Jupyter kernel. And so what would happen is you open Interact, let's say, and you're working in Python, and you've got your code cell. You type in print, hello world.
Okay,
and
I've
got
that.
And if you have a Python kernel installed on your machine, that's the one catch. You do have to install a kernel since it's a program. What's going to happen is that the front end is going to take the code that you wrote, package it into a little message, send it over via 0MQ, which is a messaging protocol, to the kernel. The kernel is going to take that message, parse it out, figure out what you want it to do with it, and then send the response back to you to render. And that response would be the text, hello world. So it's just a way for a front end and a back end to communicate with each other.
Okay, so then that means that as a .NET developer, if I wanted to make an Interact notebook, I could theoretically figure out if there is a binding for .NET and 0MQ, and it turns out, of course, that there is one. It's been around for many years. And then I could type C-sharp code or F-sharp code or whatever makes me happy, and then have that one process, which is my basically my server side, but it's really local to my machine.
Yeah. Exactly. And you could do that with multiple programming languages. There's a rich community of kernels in the Jupyter ecosystem. So the popular ones like Python and Julia and R exist. I'm a bit of a Lisp geek, so there is a common Lisp kernel for those who are curious. There's Ruby kernels. There's Haskell kernels. There's tons. If you Google around, you're guaranteed to find a kernel for the programming language that you're excited about. Or if you want to, you can like build one and give back to the community.
And is that some? Is the kernel something like it doesn't come with the kernel? You get that separately, and you have to run it separately.
Yeah, it doesn't come with the kernel. You have to get it separately. We are working on Interact to integrate the desktop application with some default kernels. It goes back to kind of making it a low technical barrier for users so that you don't have to install anything anymore. It just kind of all comes in one with a basic kernel to start.
You could even have a kernel gallery and from within Interact say, go and get me, R.
Oh, it's an interesting idea.
Because, for example, if I load up Interact right now, it says not connected. And it's like, well, gosh, what are my choices? What are my options? Yeah. I went to the file menu looking for like examples and stuff like that. So I started out looking at there's an intro one, and it's really kind of cool. It's like a web browser, but you'll have a bunch of text and you'll have images and you're like, oh, I'm on the web. But then there's code and it's right there and it's syntax highlighted and it can be run in place.
Yeah. It's super fun.
It is super fun. And do you find yourself using this for, do you mostly work on it or do you actually use it when you're trying to explore a problem from a data perspective?
A little bit of both. I work on it. Sometimes when I use it, it is an alpha project currently. So when I use it, I'll find a bug and then I'll like get distracted and end up fixing the bug instead of working on the thing I was supposed to work on. But like I said before, I do teach data science workshops, so I use it regularly now to create the content for my workshops in the form of an interactive notebook.
Well, that's interesting. So then are you saying that one could sit down in Data Science 101, set this up, and spend, a couple of weeks exploring everything? And this is the browser, this is the Word and Excel and everything all in one place.
Yeah, that's actually a really great perfect use case for it is for students. One of the biggest deterrents for a lot of people who want to learn programming or learn something technical is the setup involved, which can be pretty complex sometimes. But Jupyter is super easy. Interact and Jupyter as well, which is the grandpa, is super easy to kind of load up and access.
And do you see this as an IDE? Is this like the Visual Studio for data science? And people would live and work and spend 8 hours in this thing?
I wouldn't call it an IDE. I don't think you would use it for development per se. I think a better name for it might be an ICE, an interactive communication environment. And the idea is that you can write content in this and write code cells. You wouldn't, you know, start off and write a huge Python code file in this. That's probably better for Atom or Vim or whatever code editor you're comfortable with. But when you're looking to integrate a lot of prose and narrative with code, this is the perfect environment for you.
Ah, okay. So this gets me thinking about what we're seeing in the world of news right now with like the Washington Post, the New York Times doing these amazing interactive things. Someone has gone and written the scripts, done the data science, and now it's time to translate that into a format for normal humans to understand.
Yeah. So this brings up a great point. There's a really popular use case in journalism. BuzzFeed actually does a lot of great journalism work and a lot of data-driven journalism work. And one of the things they do is release a lot of their data journalism in the form of these interactive notebooks. And you can find them on BuzzFeed's GitHub organization. So if you wanted to, maybe BuzzFeed did a piece of journalism that you're really curious about, you can go to their GitHub, download the data file, and then open it up and interact and play with the data yourself and be your own data journalist.
Interesting. Now, that's funny because with all due respect to BuzzFeed, I don't necessarily have in the past thought about them as being a news organization, but what they are is a new digital organization. And they are pushing the boundaries of what we think of as being journalism.
Absolutely. And they're playing into the whole kind of interactive computing and literate coding experience very well. They're good trendsetters. Yeah.
So then these notebooks can be shared easily. And when someone says, here are the facts, they can write an article about it. They can just say, here's the notebook. Play with it yourself. The facts are the facts.
Yeah. So one of the things that we have integrated into Interact right now is the ability to publish a notebook directly to GitHub as a GIST. And hopefully in the future, we'll be able to add the ability to publish it to a Medium post or a WordPress blog. Or any other kind of resource or web platform that you have. So it really does start to become a content authoring platform and a communication platform. Yeah.
Being able to publish it to Medium would definitely lower the barrier.
That is on my to-do list of things I want to do because it's a feature that I'm really excited about. I've been meaning to start publishing a lot of my data explorations online. But sometimes it's such a hassle taking a notebook I've been working on and getting it to the web. Being able to just hit file, publish, Medium, and have it up would be amazing.
Now, I do want to tease you a little bit because I've never heard it pronounced GIST, and now I feel like there's going to be a hard G, soft G fight. Another GIF, you know, another GIF, GIST.
So this is something I constantly have. I pronounce GIF as GIF, and I get
that's how it's pronounced.
You are one of the GIF people.
I'm a GIF person.
Absolutely. I have found you, Scott. We need to stick together because there are cruel GIF people out there.
These hard G people are just mean, including the inventor of the format, which is also wrong.
I know. Oh, my goodness. I can't believe it.
But I say GIST.
GIST. Okay. I didn't know, and I didn't want to be attacked by the hard G crowd on the internet, but
they're really a brutal crowd. They're probably going to stop listening to this show now that they've had...
I know they're
just, now that this interview has fallen apart at the end now.
It has. They've just discovered what a terrible person I am. I pronounce things with a soft G.
All right. So what I'm hearing is that when you all decided to make Interact, you wanted a nice desktop experience with, you know, a native desktop experience. And it looks great on Windows and on Mac. Okay.
Awesome.
You wanted in-app support. You wanted publishing. Sharing should be easy. And you didn't want it to feel like a terminal because it doesn't feel like a terminal. It feels like you're writing a Word document and there's just code in the middle somewhere.
Yeah.
And it really is quite minimalist. There's no toolbar. It is almost like, speaking of Medium, it almost looks like Medium except with data and code in the middle of it.
Yeah, it does adopt the minimalist philosophy very well.
And now you're saying that you're gonna do for the future. What's the roadmap? Publishing to Medium. What else are you gonna add?
Great question. For anyone who's listening, you can check out our GitHub org. We've got a repository called Initiatives, and that lays out some of the future plans for work we have on the project. I can go through a couple of the big initiatives. The first is real-time collaboration. And that's because in addition to writing the stories ourselves, we often write the stories in teams. So wouldn't it be great if I could open up a Jupyter notebook in Interact, and you could open up the same notebook on your machine, and we can work together on it the same way that we would in Google Docs or any other platform that has real-time collaboration in it. So that's one of our big initiatives. Another is integration with Git, the version control system. And that's because a lot of people want to be able to track changes in the content they produce and be able to back it up the same way that you would code. So we want you to be able to kind of add and commit straight from the desktop interface to a Git repository and then perhaps have it backed up on GitHub or Bitbucket to be shared with your team in some way. Oh, one of our other initiatives is, I mentioned, this is built using React. So the idea is to expose all of the different components that we use in Interact so that other people can build their own interactive notebooks using our components. So if you want to have a component that's a code cell in your project, you could pull it in. If you want to have a component that's a markdown cell, you could pull it in. Any of the components you have, we have, would be publicly available as packages for people to use. So those are our three big initiatives, real-time, Git integration, and then exposing a composable ecosystem for other people to build on top of.
Very cool. Mm-hmm. And so folks can check out Interact at Nteract, interact.io.
Yes.
And people can check you out and your stuff at safia.rocks.
Yes.
So rocks is actually your top level domain.
Yes, it is.
That's pretty fabulous.
It was the best $10 I ever spent.
$10.
Yeah.
You know, there's some other aspiring data scientist named Safia out there who is pretty mad at you right now.
Oh gosh, sorry. I hope she doesn't pronounce G with a hard G.
I was just gonna say she's a hard G person, and we don't care about her.
Yes.
Thanks so much for chatting with me today.
Thank you for having me.
This has been another episode of Hansel Minutes, and we'll see you again next week.